It was hung next to George VI and the RA, to our mutual amusement. I've always refused to sell this picture.
The war changed Louis's life as it changed everyone's. He was in America when it broke out. His friend Eleanor Clark says,
I spent a day with him at the World's Fair in 1939. It was the perfect place for him. For one day's worth, it was just made for him. The ludicrous was, of course, everywhere, as it's bound to be in World's Fairs. He was in his perfect role of spectator. And I think of his face the whole day, as I saw it many other times, in front of all sorts of modern technological vulgarities, convulsed with laughter of that wry sort that he had. It was halfway between a giggle and a snort, and which, if things went a little bit over the edge of the ludicrous, could be a very different expression, one that I've never seen duplicated in any human face, of the most astonished scorn. He did turn out a massive amount of work. I never knew anyone with so much discipline who wore so little of it on their sleeve. He was prepared to wander shyly and elegantly through all of life, and one really couldn't imagine how the extraordinary quantities of work, including a great deal of academic work, got done. But they did get done, because he could turn off nuisances in a wonderful way. This was a very graceful trait. I never saw him harried by any of that.
Louis was very fond of America. He loved it like some rich raree show. And he was unfit for military service. But
I think that even with the qualities and the people he loved in this country, he came more and more to know that this was a wrong country for him at that moment, and that the only right country was England. Whatever he felt toward America, whatever he may have felt toward Ireland, the right country for him was England, the right city for him was London.
In his last book of poems, The Burning Perch, there is one called Goodbye to London, which has the refrain, nevertheless, let the petals fall fast from the flower of cities all. And this was really what Louis thought about London, when at the end he was trying to say goodbye to it. During the war, he came to know the city more intimately than he ever had before, partly as a fire watcher, when he saw it burn, and partly because he joined the BBC as a producer in the features department. And his work there continuously involved him in the lives of other people, as actors, actresses, technicians, and musicians with whom he had to work, and as the raw material of the programmes he produced. Some of these programmes, like The Dark Tower or Prisoner's Progress, were classics of radio. But to a friend, what was interesting in his work for the features department was that it released and stimulated elements in Louis's character which normally did not find any outlet. William Empson describes him as a producer.
When I first got to know Louis, I didn't think of him mainly as a poet, but as a producer. It was during the war I was described as Chinese editor, arranging shortwave broadcasts by Chinese speakers, propaganda to China, in fact. But I was very keen to get propaganda about the Chinese on the home. And Louis was a tower of strength for putting on little elegant features about boating on the lakes at Nanking or whatnot. You could show him the rough material, and he knew at once what you could put over, what would do. Even with quite a complicated script, one run-through would be enough after he had cut it. He was always unruffled, and very much the captain at the wheel of his ship. Of course, this may have been because he thought it such tuppenny work that he wouldn't bother, but the result seemed to me very elegant. He was very equable, one might think rather low-powered, but you had to look out when he began to look like a camel. That meant he had become decided.
The BBC also sent him, as an extremely sharp-eyed observer, to places and scenes he would otherwise not have dreamt of visiting. With Winfred Vaughan Thomas, he went to India at the climax of the crisis of partition.
As we journeyed through those long, hot Indian days together, and we had Jack Dillon, our BBC producer, with us too, and both Jack and I felt that we saw this detached Louis with his orderly thinking shaken completely, because, surprisingly enough, he was immediately attracted to that vast muddle that we call Indian life. You know, nothing ever happened at time or in the right place, and we were continually receiving unexpected deputations from eager young poets. They talked the whole day through, and Louis they treated with that flattering deference that the educated Indians give to a man who, as one of them once said to me, is surely a walking representative of your higher culture. Well, Louis, Jack and I went down through the Deccan, through a little village outside Conjeeveram, and we found that we'd walked straight into a temple procession. They were dragging the enormously carved temple car through the streets, 300 devotees hauling and gongs beating, and Louis threw himself into it just as if he was watching the Wales v Ireland rugby match. And of course he liked everything about southern India. But when we went up into the Punjab, it was then that India and Pakistan gave him a severe shock. We walked straight into the massacres that followed partition, and I remember once driving with Louis to a little village called Shahpura. We got there to find that there had been a terrible massacre, and that very morning, bodies everywhere, the survivors huddled together, frightened, inside a Sikh temple. And it was Louis's first sight, I think, of violence, death, complete and utter disorder, and he was visibly, physically shaken by it. But I'll never forget when the refugees saw us, they clustered round us. We were, after all, representative of some sort of order in the middle of that chaos. And suddenly I saw a totally different Louis, one I never imagined existed. Louis is a man of action. He ordered those people into a nearby lorry. We got some sort of structure going of a way to get them out of the refugee area into something like safety. And there suddenly he was ordering people about. They were obeying him. A totally different Louis I suddenly saw revealed. And also a Louis who was no longer the detached observer, but one deeply and profoundly involved in the human dilemma.
The BBC also provided the opportunity and the means for his remarkable translation of Goethe's Faust. All the more remarkable because Louis did not know a word of German. It was done in collaboration with his friend Ernst Stahl, now professor of German at Oxford.
In fact, we translated two-thirds of the whole work, which has something like 12,000 lines. And the way this was done, Louis sketched out a plan of the whole plot. Louis really did have an unerring way of deciding what was material for his own purpose and what was, though excellent theatre or very good poetry, unsuitable for the purpose he had in mind. I kept on telling him that Shelley had translated parts of Faust, but he steadfastly refused to look at Shelley's translation. He didn't think much of Shelley as a poet. He often said that Shelley was slipshod, and he certainly wouldn't look at any other translations. And so what we had to do was to work on a very rudimentary basis to begin with. I had to give a quite literal translation line by line, in ungrammatical, with very simple syntax. And Louis then wrote in his remarks and seemed to know exactly where the lines were to go. And what surprised me really was the way he succeeded in making an almost line-by-line translation. Fisto was the character he sympathized with very much. Certain of Faust's aspirations appealed to him, but not all of them. And I think he is at his best in this translation when his own sympathies were engaged. He's not always at his best when Goethe is slack or loose in poetic style, and Louis went perhaps too far in following Goethe there. But when it came to reproducing Goethe's own stricter forms, particularly the lyric forms, I really cannot see how anybody can better the poetic renderings that Louis managed to produce.
Louis had the somewhat ruthless gift of taking out of everyone and everything just what he needed for his own purposes. But in return, he gave the most he could of himself. Alan Rawsthorne describes what it was like to work with him on a production.
I don't think that one would call Louis particularly musical man in the conventional sense of the word, but on the other hand, he had a very great sense of what he wanted the music to be doing, and he had an extraordinary knack, I think, of getting what he wanted, probably because he could explain very well what he was trying to do, if one was sufficiently stupid not to realise that from the script. It's comparatively rare to find somebody who has this sensibility. He was, as I was saying, perhaps not ordinarily speaking musical, but on the other hand, he had certain tastes. And an example which I like always to have before me is to be expressed in three lines of one of his poems, one of the late ones that he wrote, where he says, "On the podium, in lieu of a man with fallible hands, is ensconced a metal lobster with built-in tempi." Now, a man who could write those lines certainly knew a bit about the problems that musicians have to face.
This gift of working with others might be thought surprising in one who is so essentially solitary and alone. Auden says,
"A don, a scholar, and an extremely reticent man. During all the years I knew him, I can remember very few occasions when he spoke intimately about his personal life, even at times when I knew he was having trouble. There was, I think, in this reticence, a close relation to another trait in him which always puzzled me, his gregariousness. Being by temperament someone who likes to drink, either by himself or with one other, I could not understand his pleasure in sitting in pubs with a group for hours and hours, a group of colleagues and cronies. I believe now that he needed group company, with men at any rate, because intimacy frightened him, and in order to forget for a while the melancholia from which he always suffered. With a friendly crew, we can forget ourselves. With a single companion, unless it be the loved one, we cannot."
Anyone who does not share Louis' shy kind of sociability would find it difficult to understand those drunken, slightly louche, and uninhibited evenings one spent in his company.
I remember him standing at the bend of the bar in the George, the BBC pub in Great Portland Street, with a group of us who were friends or cronies, with, but not strictly of, the company. You got the impression that he was sighting you through his eyes, you know, taking a sight of you. Always with a notebook ready to hand for entering bets or debts at the back of it. And then again he'd pick on a chance remark of yours and he would say, "Let me pick your brain, my dear fellow." And a few questions and something would go down in the notebook for future use. If he didn't like anybody, he'd say, "Ach, that fella." And the worst thing he could say of anybody was, "He isn't warm." And then you get that bent black safety pin of the eye and the hidalgo curl of the lip on the other side. And some of us called him Old Snarler for that. But it wasn't quite that way. He had a wistful envy of men of action. He'd have liked to have been a first-class rugby player, and he would like to have taken part in the war. And that I'm quite sure. And that came out, as I say, wistfully. And with it all, he had a concealment of scholarship. Some people trail their scholarship. Louis never. He could rarely quote a poem, but if you tried to pick him up on a quotation, out would come the notebook, and he'd bet you, and you'd invariably lose. And again, speaking of his scholarship, shortly before his death, and before the appearance of the Burning Perch, a group of us was in the George, and we asked him whence the title came. And one of our number was a D.Litt of Trinity College, Dublin, and I'm afraid there was a great deal of facetious chatter about this. And Louis was quite unruffled, just leant back, and sighted us as usual through his eyes. And then he said quite casually in a throwaway voice, "It comes from Bunyan."
Some friends of Louis's discuss how he appeared to them.
I think it's difficult to know, with a person like Louis, whether he is changing or whether you are simply getting to know him better. I think it probably is that I got to know him, I think, better and better the longer I knew him. This may seem a rather silly thing to say, because it may be thought that it's true of everybody, but it isn't, as a matter of fact, because the more you knew of Louis, I think the more you realised that there was to know. He was, had a curious ability that I used to notice of drawing down a kind of velvet curtain before himself.
I much admired that, I must say. I admired it. Total withdrawal.
Nobody could take offence at it or anything like this, really, but it was simply there, and it was raised again when it was suitable. He had this strange ability also, I think, to make you do things, and it didn't stop at productions of his works either. It advanced into private life many, many times when he has said, I'm going to so-and-so tonight, I think it would be terribly boring, you'd better come too. And I would say, well, I don't think so, Louis, not perhaps tonight, I'm awfully tired. But in about 5 minutes, one would find oneself in a cab doing precisely what Louis had wanted you to do, you see. I don't mean to say that he was a selfish man at all, because he wasn't, but usually it finished up all right. But he certainly had an ability for guiding people, I think, along the ways which he preferred.
If he went to a party of Louis, nobody could be more amusing, could defy time more. Indeed, one could spend 24 hours without any repose whatsoever, just walking about, talking, drinking, laughing, and the time was gone. And nobody was more gay to be with.
Then there were the nights at Clarence Terrace, Regent's Park, all-night parties, and in Dublin, and in Belfast. And he would always read poetry aloud. He'd recite Housman above all, lying down at full length, you know, in the devotional attitude which I told him reminded me of the correct firing position for a Bren gunner, and that didn't please him at all. He would look at me and, with a view to my military history, say, I said I will list for a lancer. Oh, who would not sleep with the brave? And then invariably he would end up with the Queen of Air and Darkness. He returned to that almost obsessionally. And when the night had worn out and the day had come on, he would say, let's go out and look at the dawn.
He very much liked the company of women.
I think he was able to feel very much at home in the company of women.
He did. He liked them too.
Oh, he liked them in every possible way, I think.
He did depend upon their company in some way. There's no doubt about that.
I think possibly women knew him better than men did.
He didn't like to get involved with things, and he had what I used to twit him about afterwards. I had said the hand-off look in his face. He certainly was not forthcoming. He did not welcome people to him, but it was just entirely shyness.
But of course, if he didn't like a person, he could get an almost oriental look of dislike in his face. I learned very soon not to introduce him to people who were boring. You know, he didn't suffer fools gladly at all. I was rather terrified of him for a long time.
Was, I think, very simple, but like all very simple men, he was extremely complicated. McNeice, if he had a glass in his hand, you were well on the way to entertain him. But it was a matter entirely for McNeice whether he bloomed with the glass. He could, as Mercy just said, be extremely silent and rather forbidding. For example, you didn't talk poetry shop with him unless he invited it. He didn't invite criticism from anyone.
But once he liked a person, he liked them forever. And he was completely loyal and generous to his friends. No matter what they did to him or borrowed from him, they were his friends forever. And he loved singing. He loved all the old party tunes, the Sash, Cavan Barry. And at a certain stage in the evening, he would start to dance. He had a little sort of almost African dance that he did of his own.
A sort of shuffle. And then he composed once a song called Reach Me Hat and Let Me Go, which was almost a theme song for him. Well, reach me my hat and let me go. I've an engagement at 2:30. Goodbye, Lily, and goodbye, Kate. If I'm not home early, then I'll be late. I'll see you once and I'll go my way. I'll see you again on the judgment day. Goodbye, Lily, and goodbye, Kate. If I'm not home early, then I'll be late.
But behind and apart from all this was the long, determined and sure-set purpose, not merely to be a poet, which he assuredly was, but to go on writing poems and better poems as long as he lived.
Dandy, scholar, shy, melancholic, and poet. The two primal experiences upon which his poetic world was based were, I think, firstly, a sacred landscape, bleak, Irish, northern, and secondly, childhood nightmares. At any rate, he always writes well when his subject is a landscape, rural or urban, and in poems, even when at first they seem light-hearted, in which one presently becomes conscious of a lurking terror. Here's a poem which embodies both characteristics. Seen from above, the foam in the curving bay is a goose quill that feathers, unfeathers itself. Seen from above, the field is a flap and the haycock's buttons to keep it flush with the earth. Seen from above, the house is a silent gadget whose purpose was long since obsolete. But when you get down, the breakers are cold scum and the rack sizzles with stinking life. When you get down, the field is a failed or a worthwhile crop, the source of backache, if not heartache. And when you get down, the house is a maelstrom of loves and hates where you, having got down, belong. In every successful poem, the feelings are brought under control and into order. And in this poem, I can see how MacNeice uses the weapons of verbal eloquence and restraint to subdue strong and potentially dangerous emotions. Horace, although, or perhaps because of a very different temperament, was a valuable influence. And in one of his latest poems, Memoranda to Horace, MacNeice pays him this tribute. It is noisy today as it was when Brutus fell on his sword. Yet through wars and rumours of wars, I would pitch on the half-chance my voice to reach you. Yours had already crossed the same gap to the north and future, offering no consolation, simply telling me how you had gathered your day, a choice it is mine to emulate.
Towards the end of his life, he picked up in that way, which you only find in really good poets, and just when you say that's the end of them, they do their best work. And I think his last two books, Solstices and The Burning Perch, are very good indeed, and quite full of intense and rather strange feeling. Many of the poems seem to me to have a premonition of his death, but he wrote himself that although they were about death, that was, he thought, an accident, and not because he was thinking about it a great deal, but because the subject was presented to him by other people in various ways. When I reviewed one of these books of poems, I said that he was the tortoise to Auden's hare, meaning that Auden could do the same kind of thing in one sonnet that it took MacNeice about 3 pages of poetry to say, and also that Auden just had that sort of dazzling quality which nobody else has got. All the rest of my review was high praise, I may say, but when I saw Louis MacNeice, he didn't say anything about the praise, as no author ever does. He just said, I'm sorry you should think Auden's the hare and I'm the tortoise. And so I said, well, don't forget the tortoise won. And he smiled his rather frosty smile and changed the subject.
The deplorable modern habit of labouring poets by decades disingenuously implies they never write anything worth reading after the decade assigned to them is over. Whether this was in fact true of any writers of our generation, I shall not venture to say. But in the case of Louis MacNeice, I know it to be nonsense. On the contrary, I am quite certain that his last 2 volumes contain his finest work. Like all poets to whom writing comes easily, MacNeice did not always prune as much as he should have done. One feels for some of his earlier poems they would be better if they were shorter. But in his last years he had completely overcome this weakness. Let me quote from this period. Dandelions. Incorrigible, brash, they brightened the cinder path of my childhood, unsubtle, the opposite of primroses, but unlike primroses, capable of growing anywhere, railway track, pierhead, like our extrovert friends who never make us fall in love, yet fill the primroseless, roseless gaps. Cats. Incorrigible, uncommitted, they leave the long flat hours of my childhood subtle, the opposite of dogs, and unlike dogs, capable of flirting, falling, and yawning anywhere, like women who want no contract but going their own way, making the way of their lovers lighter. Corncrakes. Incorrigible, unmusical, they bridge the surrounding hedge of my childhood, unsubtle, the opposite of blackbirds, but unlike blackbirds, capable, anywhere they are, of endorsing summer, like loud men round the corner, whom we never see but whose raucous voices can give us confidence. The sea. Incorrigible, ruthless, it rattled the shingly beach of my childhood. Subtle, the opposite of earth, and unlike earth, capable, any time at all, of proclaiming eternity, like something or someone to whom we have to surrender, finding, through that surrender, life. Work of this quality entitles us to use two lines of Agnes's as a fitting epitaph. This man with a shy smile has left behind something that was intact.
A house can be haunted by those who were never there, if there was where they were missed. Returning to such, is it worse if you miss the same, or another, or none? The haunting, anyway, is too much. You have to leave the house to clear the air. A life can be haunted by what it never was, if that were merely glimpsed. Lost in the maze that means yourself, and never out of the wood. These days, though lost, will be all your days. Life, if you leave it, must be left for good.